Good evening, everyone. So glad to see you all. Let's start with a prayer. Lord, thank you for gathering the faithful here tonight, that we might open our minds and hearts to understand the world as it is, although not as it should be. Help us to understand so that we might truly pray and advocate for this world, which you love, which you've created, and which you are trying to reconcile to yourself and restore that which we have broken. Thank you, Lord, for letting us gather to consider these matters together as a family of faith. And we pray for the presence of our Lord Jesus and His Spirit so that we might come to better understanding and then develop the courage to act for the greater good. We pray all these things in your holy name. Amen. All right, before we proceed with today's class, I thought we could just talk about last week a little bit. How did it settle? Did it settle, or is it kind of undigested? I'll just say that those of us who were preparing for it felt like we had to err on the side of being a bit overly simplistic, which, if it's complex, it's not good because we don't understand it. If it's overly simplistic, it's not good because we make something, it becomes a caricature of something rather than the thing itself. However, economics, especially the many levels of obscurity that is embedded in the neoliberal economic system, is so designed to confuse us that we felt we had to err on the side of being a bit simplistic. And then once we understand the basics, then we can add the actual layers of complexity back on. Does that make sense as a strategy? All right. So yeah, just taking it at face value would not be good to just leave it there. That's why we're doing it over 5 weeks. But anyway, some thoughts or comments, questions? Got it?
Sorry. Why are you smiling?
That's how I always am.
Well, one of the things, at the end someone asked, are there other people or other churches? And I think we really want to be careful that we're still in a discovery, that we don't have all the answers, and, mm-hmm. and be careful that we we're moving towards, and you know, even you've said yourself that you've changed in your way you see your theology, mm-hmm. and how you see things, and just making sure that we understand that it's in a process even for our own understanding, and there's mm-hmm. other people probably that have it that we're not aware.
Yeah, well, I may have answered the question too flatly. In terms of, this is an exciting time we live in, because I think increasing numbers of people are asking good questions, hard questions, that are aiming for deeper and deeper levels of truth. We certainly are not the only ones in that search. But I heard the question as, are there other churches that are dealing at this level of analysis? And just a flat answer to that, as far as I know, in the Twin Cities, is no. That doesn't mean that people aren't struggling, that people aren't being faithful. We definitely don't have a corner on faithfulness or on inquiry even, or trying to understand. But there's, you know, that doesn't make us better at all. It just means we, over the years, have developed the capacity to speak in such a way that, I mean, one of the reasons why other churches can't speak like this easily is because it would really drive away the money. To put it as bluntly as possible. And it's amazing that, you know, in our church we have some people, you know, who make six figures, and we have people who make way less. And there is a kind of a consensus that we're all in it together, that even those of us who are able to profit more from it still understand that overall this is a system that's designed to benefit the very few. And basically victim blame the rest and shame them as if they're at fault for not working hard enough or not being clever enough. so I'm sorry if it came out like, yeah. Mm-hmm. Other questions or comments? Yes.
What really bothers me, and I really think I can show it first, is that when you really look at the society, there's so many people who have a lot of subsidies. Mm-hmm. For example, like mortgage, so many things. Mm-hmm. But what they're coming down to is that people who don't have, they just get a little crumbs, you know. So this healthcare reform, too, that... You know, there are certain pocket of people that really need this Obamacare or whatever people call for the what is called that condition that they already
have. Pre-existing conditions.
Yeah. So, but you know what? They try to really distort it in many ways that they really ignore those people who really need help. Mm-hmm. So this is why I really think that what where you're going, that's
right.
Refreshing, and I have never heard of any other churches that how we approach things here.
Oh, thank you, Ms. Kim. One of the things that we remind ourselves almost every day at Underground Seminary is that our primary goal is de-euphemizing terms. Like taking a euphemism, exposing it for what it really is. For instance, what's the difference between welfare and subsidy? Yeah. Welfare is bad, right? Like, people should stop getting welfare and get a job. Get a job. But what about whole industries who get subsidies? So, yeah, it's a subsidy is a euphemism for government support. And we give massive amounts of government support, well, government welfare, to corporations that don't need it. Like the oil industry. The coal industry, pharmaceuticals that make billions in profits, multinational banks. I mean, it's ridiculous how much welfare we give to corporations, right? And then when we give a tiny little bit to the ailing, to the elderly, to the sick, you know, to the poor, then so we victim blame, right? There are people that are victims of a very cruel system, and then we blame and shame them. And then what we do with corporations, we have all kinds of fancy words. So understanding the euphemisms in our national vocabulary is critical to clearing our minds and comparing apples with apples and oranges with oranges, right?
Right. And also the tax, you know, the super rich don't pay as much tax.
Right. And why do we stop the share of Medicare tax at, what is it, like $100,000 or something for the elderly? I mean, there's a cap on your tax. So if you make $1 million, you should pay the proportional share of that $1 million. But you're only taxed for your Medicare up to, I think, $100,000 or $120,000 or something. So that means if you make $1 million, about 900,000 of it, you're not taxed at all, right?
You're probably not going to need Medicare if you have Medicare.
So you
doesn't
have to help.
No, you help none of those.
All right. Other questions or comments? Yes, Lori.
You know, one thing I guess I've been thinking about all week was that graph at the end where it talked about the tribal life and then the nation, city state, nation state, and then
corporate state.
And like, At first I was like, well, if we are moving farther and farther away from it, does that mean we have to move back into nation state and city state again? You know, I was like, that doesn't make sense.
No.
And so how, so I guess just wrestling with like, well, so how does it look like now? Because it's not a regression back through those other things that we've been through the history. Is it just a new way? And I guess that's what I've just been thinking about a lot.
Mm-hmm. And Jesus didn't say, hey, you know, this place is overrun by the Roman Empire. Let's all pack up and go to, you know, some other place And if there happen to be people, just kick them out and then colonize it, right? I mean, like, Jesus was, how do we do the good, humane, ancient ways in this new context? And that's all we're trying to do. Jesus, you know, took his time, his space, his historical location as is, and then infuse it with God's values. So we're not going anywhere. But how do we infuse our time and place with God's kingdom values? And whatever small incremental steps we take are steps of faithfulness. Anything else? All right, great. Then let's proceed. So we continue with the American century.
Do you want to maybe say where we are in terms of the 5 weeks?
Yes. We are in a period of 1914 to 1945. What is that the beginning of and what is that the end of? Right. Beginning of World War I and the end of World War II. So World War I was 1914 to 1918, but the U.S. enters World War I in 1917. Okay, just in time to be part of the victors and get the spoils. Isn't that great? The U.S. is wonderfully opportunistic throughout its history. We've gotten lucky many, many times. Same thing with World War II. It actually begins in 1939 when Germany under Hitler invades, not France, is Poland?
Poland?
Yeah.
Our military wasn't as strong back then. We didn't develop
the
military-industrial complex until after World War
I,
right?
Yep. The U.S. waits. It still has tremendous industrial capacity, and it's shipping a whole bunch of armaments. In fact, it's making money by selling arms to European, not technically allies, but traditional allies. So in 1941, at the end of 41, when Japan bombs Pearl Harbor, it becomes the pretext that the U.S. needs to enter World War II and be there for about 3.5 years to be part of the next victor class. It wasn't assured for sure, but still, it was a tremendous opportunity for the U.S. to pick up all the spoils after that great war. So that's the period we're dealing with, and we are calling it neoliberal stirrings. So it's not formal neoliberalism. But it's the beginnings, you know, the birth pangs that will eventually bring neoliberalism into the world. So neoliberalism is just another way of saying hypercapitalism. So it's about the sloshing money around that's kind of disconnected from actual manufacturing even. It's basically taking the profits of capitalism and then gambling with it, right? Basically Wall Street and London and the Bourse in Paris and the Nikkei in Japan. It's just like so many levels abstracted from the real world. It's super rich people gambling with our money. So how about we just paint the big picture? Everybody have a copy? This was written, revised. It was really tight. So we'll stop after each paragraph to just get a breath and see if we can internalize it. So the big picture of this period is that the United States was birthed out of stolen land from Turtle Island. That's what Native people called this place, North America. And stolen labor from Africa. That's our birth, theft and murder, right? But the backdrop to that is that the insecurity caused by intra-European conflict and competition on one hand and unadulterated greed on the other are the twin pillars of our republic and its underlying script. As we mentioned last week, when Spain colonized the New World, they got enormous amounts of wealth, which then they used to build a Spanish Armada and colonize other European countries. that made the Netherlands and then England and Germany and other countries try to get colonial wealth from the New World, from Africa, Asia, other places, to defend themselves against Spain and later each other. So this intra-European rivalry, conflict, and warfare is one of the driving forces of the colonization, basically the European-inflicted Holocaust around the world. Got it? And also unadulterated greed, the twin pillars of our republic, and its underlying scripture, right? America's true scripture is hateful competition and unadulterated greed. The doctrine of discovery, refined in a series of papal bulls, that means pronouncements by the Pope, in the late 15th and early 16th centuries, provided a theological rationale for land theft and the inevitable genocide. White supremacy, the core American ideology that justified slavery, drew from Plato's dualism, good, bad, right, wrong, up, down, spiritual, material. Reformed theology, basically predestination, and social Darwinism, that the fittest survive. And since Europeans were best at killing and surviving, we must be the ultimate evolved human beings. Might makes right, and therefore have a God-given right to oppress, exploit, even to destroy other human beings. See, that's social Darwinism. Got it? All right. Where are we? Are we okay? Englishman Adam Smith, who is an ancestor to Andrew Smith. is that right? Was he here?
No, he wasn't.
Oh, well, he can't refute that, can he? That's what happens if you're not here. Provided the intellectual framework for modern capitalism in his The Wealth of Nations, published in the same year as the Declaration of Independence across the Atlantic, the pond, as we call it. European empires in this time were driven by the insatiable desire for profit by the ruling capitalist class and self-justified through the doctrine of white supremacy. The rationale went something like this. Since white people are saved and enlightened, while non-white people are heathen and primitive, conquest, exploitation, forced conversion, and paternalism are all natural, even God-ordained. The white capitalist elites employed divide-and-conquer strategies based on racial hierarchy, which included a bait-and-switch scheme for poor European immigrants and increased their power and influence across an expanding United States. That's a little bit more complicated paragraph. So any questions or comments about this? Or even if we just want to say it in our own way, that could be helpful to other people. Just on.
Just one. I heard an historian say that originally the American dream was free Indian land and free
slave labor.
Slave labor. Mm-hmm. So that was the American dream.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, isn't, but to be fair, isn't that the universal dream? Don't we all want free land and free slaves to do our work, right? I'm joking, sorry.
And then the notion of no taxation without representation kind of counters this narrative. You know, the idea that if you're going to be able to tax me, harm me, you need to give me representation, some way of having voice, a speech on the decisions you make. That's another part of the American, what made America America. So that would be a contrary theme.
Yeah, but taxation without representation also meant that American colonists wanted to do their own colonizing without British interference. So that's the larger picture and larger analysis that we have, and we're not just buying the rhetoric, you know, within the white supremacist narrative. But basically, American colonists wanted to colonize the rest of the West, and Britain said no. Great Britain said, We already said all this land is going to be Indian land. It was also very expensive for them to do that. They didn't want to do that. And so they said everything west of the Mississippi is going to be Indian territory. So that's one of the reasons why the Indians sided with the British, right? So this no taxation without representation, I call BS on that. I mean, that was it was real. But if you're not a European, that is BS. That's just another form of oppression, right?
The no taxation without representation only applied to certain classes.
Exactly.
Racist.
Lori.
When you read this paragraph, it just reminded me, we took the kids for spring break to Washington, D.C., and we went to the new African-American History Museum.
Whoa, you were able to get in?
Yeah, we were able to get in. And
wow.
If you ever get a chance to go, it's an incredible experience. But I particularly remember them talking about, and they were having like the same audio going over and over. So I kept hearing like the same two phrases like the whole time as I was watching through. So, but it talked about how, I'm of German heritage from the mid 1700s. So I was very personal to me, but it talked about how these very poor Europeans, mostly German, were actually getting together with natives and black slaves and creating riots. Mm. And they wanted to figure out how to stop these riots. And there was even like the talk of a new Declaration of Independence being written by these three groups coming together. And so what they did is they emphasized white supremacy to the white poor to break up that riot. And then the end of the audio was, and this was the beginning of white supremacy.
Mm-hmm.
And it was just like, and they just kept saying, you know, it kept going on over and over. And so I can't help but see that huge visual when I talk about that. And that my ancestors were those white poor that drank that juice.
So the U.S. Government didn't give any real remedy to poor white German and other immigrants. It gave them a psychological coping. You know that you're superior to them, and we're all kind of together, right? The English and other elites and you poor German immigrants, we're like together. Classic psychological strategy. Susie?
Is it the preamble to the Constitution, life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness?
The Declaration of Independence.
Brain fog, sorry. It was originally written, the pursuit of life, liberty, and property.
Property.
It was
life, liberty, and property, yeah.
Yeah, it was not the pursuit of happiness. But then they realized there wasn't going to be enough property to go around. So we should probably rewrite this part.
It was a pursuit of property. A.K.A. happiness.
Yeah, so life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, they got rid of the property.
Yeah.
Because that was the original goal for these Europeans coming over. Like, they're smooshed together in Europe, living on top of each other in tenements, basically.
Right.
They get on a boat, they come here, and there's this wide open territory, and everybody wants property.
Yeah, well, that's an excellent point. If happiness is a euphemism for property, then the colonists defeating their mother nation in the War of Independence actually means that even regular poor white people could pursue property, right, through westward expansion. And then Abraham Lincoln, when he signs the Homestead Act, does it even more. So Lincoln's Homestead Act in the middle of the Civil War is part of the reason why, you know, we have white settlers in Minnesota, for instance. All right, let's continue. Third paragraph. Class 2 explores the ways that American capitalists used World Wars I and II to stifle dissent about unfair and unequal distribution of wealth and to find ever creative means to gain power. Multinational corporations emerged to dominate American politics and policy, becoming the tail that wags the dog. This was the groundwork for the larger goal of American corporate supremacy in the global economy. Under Franklin Delano Roosevelt, who was elected to four terms, although he didn't live out his fourth term, corporations served the national interest. Under Reagan, the national interest became to serve the multinational corporations, so it flipped. That was a fundamental shift from capitalism to neoliberalism. In other words, neoliberalism is American white supremacist hyper-capitalism gone global, in which the only goal is unlimited profit for the already wealthy and for the aspiring greedy. All right. Comments. Everybody got that? The shift from FDR to Reagan? It's still about enriching the nation and making it powerful, and it's still about enriching the corporations and making them powerful, but the tail becomes dumb. You know what I mean. The tail wags the dog under Reagan.
That will be two classes from now.
Yeah. So what happened between those 40 years plus is what you're going to get.
Yes. Thank you for asking. So, all right, then. One, America's imperial ambitions. This is our operating assumption here. The U.S. has consistently been an imperial nation, despite its consistent denial. This process intensified in the 1800s. The U.S. capitalist class consolidated its power domestically and began to test the waters globally. Can we actually do what we did in the U.S. everywhere else around the world? A drive to global expansion in search of higher return on investment, we call it ROI, right? Would eventually lead to outright imperialism. So first, westward expansion. How do we colonize North America? Through a series of deals like the Louisiana Purchase, even the fact that Hawaii and Alaska are states, and kind of almost there, Puerto Rico. Annexations, broken treaties, of course, and genocidal warfare against native peoples, the U.S. completed its conquest of North America in the early 1900s. The perverse doctrine of discovery, pronounced by a series of popes from Rome, would morph into the idea called manifest destiny in the U.S. Manifest destiny was the belief that European settlers were predestined. You see the word destiny? Were predestined by God, that's from our Reformed Presbyterian influence, to tame the Wild West, to bring salvation to a savage people living on savage land, so to speak, and to spread progress as good news. Industrialism had led to a population explosion in Europe. Land was so scarce that grueling factory work was the only option for many. Poor Europeans were lured by the promise of free land, then lured further west by gold. All these wonderful euphemisms, like salvation and progress. I'm not doing air quotes because I don't want to exacerbate my carpal tunnel, but all of these things in quotes are euphemisms, okay? We got to be able to see right through this rhetoric.
Do you want to point out that Eva Bora has a
picture? Oh!
American Progress.
How many of you are familiar with this painting, American Progress? This is Lady Liberty, is she not? She's big. Maybe she's the Green Giant's girlfriend, who knows? But here are stagecoaches and horses going west, the settlers. Here's the train and the railroad workers, especially from China, making the intercontinental railroad possible. Explorers, farmers here. Here's the Homestead Act. And then here are Native Americans fleeing even further west, right? And then here's Lady Liberty also laying down telegraph wires across America. This is telegraph here. And I'm not sure what book this is. Is this?
It's a school book.
It's a school book. Okay. Anything else going on here that I'm missing?
Roman toga. She's wearing a Roman toga.
Well, you're right. The new Roman Empire, right? Which is the U.S. is modeled after that.
She's clearly bringing light to the darkness.
Ah. Oh, see, here's darkness over here, and here's light behind her. I never noticed that.
I've never had either.
Wow. Yeah. The wild animals.
The animals on the left side, not the top. Keep going top.
Oh, here the buffalo's running away too. I see buffaloes and native people running away.
Looks like ships from Europe coming in on the right.
There's ships here. Yep. There's a bridge there.
And then it's literally called American Progress, which is the name of the painting.
Mm. Is the sun rising on the right side? Is it
setting? Oh, that's a good question.
East.
Yeah.
East going west.
Right. So it's a sunset. Well, you know I'm a contrarian, so what do you expect? So completed conquest of North America by early 1900s, from doctrine of discovery to manifest destiny. Isn't that great? And then poor Europeans lured by the promise of free land, and if you happen to be in the South, free slaves too. What a bargain.
The buffalo are pushed away for the trains and also for cattle and
right.
Privatizing of property.
Yep. At least they're honest about, you know, they're actually people and animals already here. They just gotta, all of the darkness, the savageness must be tamed by the enlightened, civilized, Christian, Roman, all that.
Where is Lady of Liberty as a woman?
I forget.
Yeah. In the French Revolution,
yeah.
There was Lady
the Flag.
The French Revolution is early 1800s, so it's actually...
Yeah, so it's precedent.
But this painting is in the mid-1800s, right? 1872, yeah.
Yeah, so it's post-French Revolution, yeah.
So this this symbol would be post-American Revolution, post-French Revolution, post-Statue of Liberty being sent to the U.S. So it's a kind of a imaginative rendering of America's past. All right, so the Civil War, 1B. It's a period of 4 years. The opening of lands to the West caused a civil war between industrial capitalists in the North, the Union, and planters, slaveholders in the South, the Confederacy. So even I was surprised to hear it like this again, the way that John had phrased this. The opening of lands to the West, right? Like, that's the precipitating cause, not some conceptual argument about slavery. The fighting was not really about slavery, but about who would profit from this new territory and thereby control the nation. The Northern capitalists won in part by using the Emancipation Proclamation to free slaves in the South, but not in Northern slaveholding states, like Maryland and Delaware and a couple of other states,
Missouri
and Kentucky. The North kept a police presence in the South at the war's end to protect the freed slaves just long enough to get an economic advantage over the Southern plantation class. There's a little error there. The Reconstruction era is 1863, possibly 1865, depending on the historian, to 1877. So please make a note of that. It's a 12 to 14-year period. And then they withdrew, unleashing the horrors of Jim Crow racism south of the Mason-Dixon line. So, Reconstruction was Northern police occupation of Southern states long enough to suppress and control the Southern economy so that Northern industry would have clear advantage. And when they had irreversible advantage, then they took their police presence out, and then now the South was able to reinstitute slavery through a new mechanism of control called Jim Crow laws, and used the prison system as a way of getting free labor in the South. And the, you know, Jim Crow laws were like, for instance, and some of these laws are still on the books, believe it or not, if you walk on the road, that's called jaywalking, right? Jaywalking is not just crossing the road. Jaywalking is walking on the road that's only designed for motor cars, for instance. But if you walk on someone's yard, that's called trespassing. In many, many places around the country, especially the South, there are no sidewalks. And if you're too poor to have a car or even a bicycle and you walk on the street to get to the nearest bus stop or to get to wherever, then you're either trespassing or you're jaywalking, and then you can go to jail for that, right? And then you have a record, and then if you can't pay the fine, then, you know, on and on and on, and next thing you know, you're in a chain gang doing free labor in prison. This is how corrupt the Jim Crow laws were. It was just designed to round up black people arbitrarily to put them in the prison labor system.
Just a little more about this economic vision piece between the two, the North and the South. In the South, cotton was becoming extremely profitable again because of trade with Britain. Mm-hmm. And so the plantation owners, slave owners, were looking for more land to expand, but also they wanted to keep free trade to grow their economy by trading with Britain, whereas the North was developing industry and manufacturing, and they were looking for higher tariffs. And they didn't want it open that much, and they were also fearful that if the South got control of this land to the West, then the South is going to become too powerful, and they would be able to, they would have all the politicians, they would totally shape the vision for the entire country. So that was why all that land to the West became a real threat, because whoever got was able to have access and influence with that was going to control the country.
The balance of power in the Senate was very tenuous and maintained, but when they allowed new states to come in place and they said they couldn't become slave states, then it was clear that the non-slave states would rule.
Mm-hmm. That North would have advantage.
Yeah.
Yeah, they'd have the greater votes in both the House and the Senate. Good point. Lori?
Yeah, I did a class at my kid's school last year where I gave the kids a blank U.S. map and two colors, one for the North and one for free states and one for slave states. And then I just read the dates of when new states were adopted into the United States. And it was just crazy. It was like 9 months, non-slave state. The next 9 months, there was a slave state and a non-slave state. So just watching it grow, like, on the paper over the years. And it was really interesting to dialogue with that with the kids. But that was such a tangible way to see what John was just talking about. That.
Right. Well, let me read C, and then we'll return to this map. Industry and urbanization. The Civil War led to rapid industrial and urban growth in the North, as did the laying of railway across the country by Chinese railway workers. The federal government encouraged the development of business and trade with high tariff protection for manufacturers. Tariff is taxes on imports and exports to encourage or discourage trading in a certain way. By the end of the 19th century, the U.S. replaced Britain as the world's leading industrial power and was beginning to test the waters of global trade. Can we go to that map again, Laura? We mentioned four northern free states, supposedly, that actually still allowed slavery: Delaware, Maryland, Kentucky, Missouri. So just to reinforce what we said earlier, we have heard it said, the phrase in the Bible, you have heard it said, but I say unto you, we have heard it said that the Civil War was a contest between the righteous North and the evil South. Right? Free states versus slave states. But actually, they were fighting to control the Western territories, and as David helpfully pointed out, it also meant votes in the Senate and the House. Control of the nation, basically. So the northern states had an economic and political incentive to make the states, free states like them, so that they can control. And the southern states had the same rationale. So it was about the rest of the country that the Civil War was about. So in 1863, in the dead middle of the Civil War, Lincoln proclaims the Emancipation Proclamation, right? Which frees a whole bunch of slaves technically to join Union forces and to help turn the tide so that the North will have victory. It was a very cynical move. And by the way, in the same year, or the year before, 1862, Lincoln pushes through the Homestead Act, which basically means open season on Native Americans living here who were there now by treaty, but it just meant all the treaties are going to be violated, right? So at the same time that Lincoln frees the slaves, he also encourages even further land theft, breaking up all the treaties, and further genocide of Native people. It's incredibly cynical. I mean, you have to, like, be white and only white and know nothing and care nothing about anybody else to believe that Lincoln was a hero. He was a limited hero, right? He was a good man, a great man, even in some ways. But if you wouldn't just call him a hero without qualification, unless you were white, basically, and ignorantly and insistently white. So the Civil War is really a contest for control, and slavery was just one issue among many.
And there was, it's not to discount, there was certainly abolitionist movements. They just didn't get a hearing at the national political level.
Mm-hmm. Lincoln, and exactly.
It became advantageous.
There. Right. Sugi?
I don't know if this is a good question, but so we're talking about the Civil War between like North and South, but then the day that we're talking about are just white people. All the races were white. Or there was like they were recognized like a poor white based on the class, and then like what races of white people from Europe were located in North more,
mm-hmm.
in South more. Also, my question would be is they were at least recognizing where their heritage was from at the time.
What was the European?
What? Yeah. What?
Ethnic breakdown
down of the country.
Yeah, in North and South and.
Mm-hmm.
Or by the time when they were fighting, it was just about North and South, and they were regarded by themselves as just become American already.
More to the east and south, I think whiteness was already pretty strong.
Mm-hmm.
Where you have more recent immigrants, like up in the north and heading west, and a lot of those are Northern European immigrants later on, the 1800s and early 1900s,
mm-hmm.
they're still identifying as, you know, whatever country they're coming from, it's a mix. But
it's complicated. Like, for instance, Germans come in waves in the 1700s. They come in another wave in the 1800s. They come in another wave in the early 1900s. So, and then like Scandinavians come in after the Civil War for the most part. So Scandinavians wouldn't really be involved in this conflict. They're not really, not in real numbers. And then Irish were there to some degree, but then the potato famine in the 1840s really increased Irish immigration. But the Irish go everywhere. They go wherever they can. So Irish are everywhere, Germans are everywhere, and the English are predominantly in the East Coast, all up and down. So it's very mixed already by the time of the Civil War. It's a good question.
Is that true that Abraham Lincoln, historians think that Abraham Lincoln went through a conversion experience based on the way his writing changed while he was in office, and that contributed to his decision to make the African-American slaves free. But at the same time, he also still may have been captured
mm-hmm.
by his ideology that mm-hmm. was exclusive towards Native Americans.
I would say both and. I think he saw the moral righteousness mm-hmm. of the anti-slavery movement, but he also said...
He was a moderate. That.
Right, but he also said if I could save the Union by, you know, letting slavery continue, I would do that.
His views changed while he was president. He had changed in heart while he was president.
Okay. All right, that's one interpretation.
That's what historians believe these days.
That's an interpretation of certain historians. There are other interpretations as well, right? Okay. Any questions about session one? This is just, we're still doing setup here.
One thing.
Yeah.
So because the North wins the war,
mm-hmm.
The South become an economic colony of the North?
Yeah, pretty much. Yep. The South is pretty much colonized by the North. And then after Reconstruction, you know, now left to fend for itself. And it takes out all this anger and aggression on the newly freed black people, basically, because they don't have enough strength to actually, you know, fight a new war with the North, right? So it's like, oh, you traitors, you know, we were your masters, and then you thought the North is going to save you, but look, they left you high and dry, and now we're going to oppress you again, and you're going to be our slaves in a new way. That's exactly what happened. So if the North was really about anti-slavery, it would not have abandoned vulnerable African-Americans in the South the way that it did, and it would have treated its own African-American residents in the North better, but it didn't. Northerners were horrible to black people everywhere, including in Minnesota. everywhere. Northerners were horrible to black people. So this is why seeing it in simplistic morality is so misleading, because if by their fruits you shall know them, that story makes no sense. The story we learned in schools, right? Because how does that story lead to the omnipresence of horrible racism to this day? You see? The dots don't connect, do they?
It also makes sense of lingering resentment in the South towards the North. Mm-hmm. That's what happened, and then we wrap it up in a narrative of self-righteousness.
Right. Yeah, I mean, like those of us who've lived in the northern part of the country say, well, we were right and they were wrong. You know, we were pro-freedom and they were pro-slavery, and they lost fair and square, so they should just get on board with it. But a lot of it had to do with economic exploitation and eventually the northern economic colonization of the South. And that's just pure greed. You know, and yeah, they lost fair and square, I guess you can say, but they find it extremely hypocritical for Northerners to wrap the entire Civil War around morality, and they're right about that, right? Okay, let's continue part two, America and the World Wars. Oh, did I miss the Spanish-American War? Sorry. D, Spanish-American War, part one. With the domestic frontier closed and industry sufficiently developed, U.S. capitalists were ready to further profit through imperial expansion overseas. Right? Now, the West was won, as they say. The Spanish-American War of 1898 was cloaked as a friendly intervention in Cuba to help locals overthrow Spanish rule, but it was really about access to resources and markets, for instance, the lumber and sugar abundant in Cuba. At the conclusion of the war, the U.S. was granted the right to intervene in Cuba. Isn't that amazing? The U.S. was granted. How did basically the U.S. seized the right to intervene in Cuba, while it also directly annexed Guam, Puerto Rico, and the Philippines. Imperialism, meaning across the borders, beyond the borders of the nation state of the United States, was now explicit. By the way, how many of you know where Guantanamo Bay is, a U.S. military base and prison? It's on Cuba. We've been at war against Cuba since Castro took over in 1960. How do we have a military base on an enemy nation? Have any of us asked that question? Pretty crazy, huh?
Some kind of deal.
Yeah. It's called imperialism. All right. So, part two, America and the World Wars. The World Wars benefited the U.S. capitalist class immensely. Industry grew, their power was consolidated, and unfettered patriotism was extolled. U.S. participation in these wars was not virtuous, but opportunistic moves by the financial elite to whip up support for war at home while gaining market access abroad. Right, so...
What do you mean by war at home?
To get support from the population for the...
Among Americans. Remember that capitalism and war go hand in hand. War is the primary driver of capitalism. Now, conceptually, that's not what we learn in economics classes, but historically, that is very true. Right. War is the primary driver of capitalism. War is the primary stimulus to capitalist growth. And if we don't have war after a while, we'll invent war to stimulate the economy. So, A, European colonial wars. World Wars I and II were European colonial wars. European progress had come through the looting of black and brown countries around the world. This created a massive arms race in Europe, with tensions brewing over boundaries, colonies, and spheres of influence, a tension that exploded in 1914. Notice that the intra-European conflict of the 1500s continues unabated right up to World War I, right?
But it was, we had 50 or so years of peace without war on the European continent during that time. Mm-hmm. So that's where all the feeling like moving into an age of progress, because mm-hmm. it was all happening elsewhere around the world. There are proxy struggles elsewhere.
Right.
So it enabled Europe to have a time of peace for 50 years.
But only a technical peace. Right. It was a bubble that just hadn't burst yet. So World War II was a continuation of World War I. Germany lost colonies in the 1919 Treaty of Versailles that doled out reparations at the end of World War I. Inspired by the U.S. colonization of Native American lands, get this, Hitler learned from the U.S. He attempted a new German colonization of Eastern Europe to make up for this loss and to raise the standard of living in Germany, be a popular leader and a hero to his people. He learned very well from American colonization and theft of native lands. So the colonial wars that European nations were fighting amongst themselves is really the rationale behind World War I. Any questions on that? Okay, World Wars I and II are European countries fighting over colonies, boundaries, and spheres of influence. So here are the colors that correspond with these nations. This maroon is Great Britain, India, Australia, parts of Papua New Guinea and Malaysia, Egypt, Sudan, Kenya, and parts of West Africa and South America, Canada, I mean just a lot. And that's just England. All right, should we move on to part B? So World War I was fought 1914 to 18, 4 years. By the way, it's just 50 years after the Civil War, right? Civil War is 61 to 65. And then World War I is 1914 to 1918. Both are four-year wars.
And this is specifically about U.S. interest in the war.
Okay, thanks for that clarification. By 1900, the capitalist business class was in full control and was looking beyond domestic markets to foreign markets. From 1897 to 1914, private foreign investments by U.S. investors go from $700 million to $3.5 billion. This is in other parts of the world, right? In 1914, the beginning of World War I, however, there was a serious recession. Fortunately, England became a primary market for American goods and loans at interest at the start of World War I, stimulating the U.S. economy. So Great Britain's war was a stimulus to the U.S. economy. American profit was closely tied to British victory, and so the U.S. entered the war in 1917 as a British ally and then reaped the rewards.
And the goods, a lot of it is weapons.
Right. Yeah, I mean, the U.S. has been an arms dealer for a long, long time. This is one of the primary profit centers, actually, for U.S. government. Do you have any idea how much weapons systems we sell to Saudi Arabia, for instance?
Yeah, we sell to both sides of conflicts.
Oh, yeah. Like we sell arms to everyone.
Fighting each other, we'll sell guns to both of you.
Mm-hmm. We're the we're the arms dealer par excellence. C, criminalization of dissent. American public sentiment was against war, especially World War I, and the financial elite after World War I. The anti... Yes.
Actually, leading up to World War I, this might have got reworded. There was a lot of dissent against the financial elite. This is when the SPA, the industrial workers of the world, these movements.
Oh right. In the
leading up to World War I, they're having a lot of problems with the working class with controlling their strikes and riots and the growth of socialism. So.
Okay. So there was a lot of working class agitation against the capitalist elite in the early 1900s, leading up to World War I. The Anti-Imperialist League was founded to protest the Spanish-American War. Further, the early 1900s saw the rapid growth of labor movements and socialism against the miserable working conditions and growing inequality brought on by industrial capitalism. The U.S. government unleashed a massive pro-war campaign as it entered World War I in 1917. The draft was instituted and patriotic support of the war was expected of all Americans. Americanization programs assimilated troublesome immigrants in the late 1910s, and the Immigration Act of 1924 restricted foreign immigration, especially from non-European countries. The government increasingly criminalized dissent through the Espionage Act and Sedition Act of 1918, slandering labor unions and imprisoning many socialists. So the timeline kind of gives further details about these various movements.
Can we just read about the Espionage Act and the timeline?
Yeah, let's do that.
You'll see on 1917, this was passed actually specifically against a prominent socialist politician who kept running for president, Eugene Debs, but then through that to silence others. So it was passed by Congress. The Espionage Act provided penalties up to 20 years in prison for whoever spoke or wrote against the war. This act was used especially to imprison socialist leaders, including Eugene Debs, to break up the movement. And it was successful. And it stayed on the, it stayed, you know, after the war. And that's what they used to go after prominent labor leaders, socialists, that were gaining a lot of traction with the public. And a lot of them were imprisoned.
So the U.S. had political prisoners.
Mm-hmm. What happened to the First Amendment, freedom of speech?
In times of war, it's suspended sometimes.
Mm-hmm. What is war? Is it war not an emergency? And can't the government declare a state of emergency in times of war and suspend civil liberties? Because our security vis-a-vis nations that are trying to destroy us, our security and survival is greater than our civil liberties. Do we all agree on that?
No. It's against martial law.
Well, you're just a bad American, Susie. Yeah. And do not strike that from the record. I want that recorded for time immemorial.
Well, it's convenient that American history is perpetual war.
So yeah.
You just make up something. You
right.
Make up rules.
Every
as it happens.
Every generation invents yeah. a war to fill out young males.
Yeah.
Same thing with
that. I think in the bigger
mm-hmm. right.
picture scheme is you're just making up the rules as you go.
Right.
Which is very convenient.
So we have World War I, and we suspend basically our constitutional civil liberties because we're in a state of emergency. And then that basically quells any kind of dissent, any kind of anti-war movement. And then after 2001, 9/11, what do we pass? The Patriot Act. What does it mean to protest the Patriot Act? What kind of person are you? You're unpatriotic. You're a traitor. And the Patriot Act basically suspends habeas corpus, which is a right to a fair and speedy trial. Can you believe that? And it's still suspended to this day. It is possible for an American citizen. Do we think that because we have a passport and citizenship that we're protected, it is possible that the U.S. government can round us up and detain us without a trial indefinitely? All they need to do is say they're working on it. They're working on putting us to trial. But a fair and speedy trial, that has been suspended because we're still in war. Right? And as long as we're in war, the U.S. government can claim a kind of state of emergency powers and suspend what we think are, what is it, ordained inalienable rights, almost like ordained by God. Oh, those inalienable rights are regularly suspended throughout our history. Isn't it scandalous?
I also want to highlight this Americanization movement, because this is like the late 1910s, early 1920s, where there was a program to across the country to get people speaking English. I mean, there are European immigrants here, the second, third, fourth generation, were still speaking Swedish, Norwegian, whatever, up until the 1920s. It was this Americanization movement that this broad educational program across the country and pushing everybody to become white if you're European, but then blocking immigration in 1924 for non-white countries. Mm-hmm. It was a massive move towards homogeneity in this country because they were having such a hard time controlling the population, the workers. And so that was that was another reaction. And then you don't have a new influx of immigrants coming mm-hmm. in anymore, so after that point, everybody just speaks.
Okay. Susie wants to make another unpatriotic comment.
Okay. We also had German-speaking enclaves in Minnesota clear through World War II. We had
That's right.
spies sent to New Ulm, Minnesota, to spy on the Germans, and then the entire town of New Ulm, like, overnight decided to start speaking English.
Mm. Wow. That's a great tidbit about Minnesota. All right.
But the restrictions on immigration in the 20s did help the African-American community, though, since they had less competition for low-income labor, less skilled workers.
I guess there will be an upside to any kind of thing.
Yeah.
All right. Should we go on to the Roaring 20s? All right. So in the 20s, the International Workers of the World was destroyed. Strikes were beaten down by force. The broader socialist movement fell apart, and immigration was significantly reduced. Prosperity increased greatly, but it was concentrated at the very top while the majority struggled. The financial elite and major political parties now controlled the media. Basically, they owned Hollywood, right? And they owned the music recording industry. They owned the newspapers. They blocked information about protests and general discontent. Then the stock market crashed in 1929 because it basically became a gambling house, just like now, leading to the Great Depression. The capitalist system itself was in question. Massive sit-downs and strikes spread again throughout the country in the early 1930s, bringing business owners to their knees. President Franklin Roosevelt created the New Deal, drawing from Keynesian economics, which is basically government investment in infrastructure, producing jobs, did not seek to transform the economic system, but to stabilize it and stop the rebellion from spreading across the country. While it provided a temporary fix for some workers, it was actually entering World War II that finally put people to work. So World War II is what ended the Great Depression. So this is a really good slide here. We have the key elements from the Roaring 20s through the Great Depression and the New Deal. Wealth is concentrated at the top. And that led to the Great Depression. We have a greater wealth disparity, greater concentration of wealth at the top now than ever in the history of our country. Financial elite control the media, block information about protest, stock market crashes in 29, depression, capitalism is in question, FDR enacts the New Deal, and World War II is a massive war stimulus to our economy.
What? So much fluoride in our water, we might be right.
When we say that FDR was still in charge of a capitalist system, I mean, think about this. In the middle of World War II, FDR said, okay, you're making this product, you're now going to make that product. You know, you were making nylon, now you're going to make bullets. I mean, he ordered all kinds of industries to do production for the war. And then a whole bunch of women entered the workforce. Remember Rosie the Riveter? And that gave women a taste of independence. I mean, yes, the women's movement really took off in the 60s and early 70s, but I think the proto-women's movement was in World War II, when a whole bunch of women got to work, make money, and not have to deal with lousy husbands every day, right? I hear some amens. Okay. Okay, yes.
Keynes and economics actually came after the Great Depression. It's sort of Keynes kind of has a theory. It was emerging in kind of everywhere. The people, governments were finding that, hey, we can, through various ways, mitigate ups and downs of the economy through having government spending offset drops in private spending.
Right.
Private investment.
Right.
And this is something that was then later formalized into Keynesian economics.
Right.
As a way of kind of dealing with the conflicts that had been too ideologically tense to deal with before.
Mm-hmm.
It was a more formal approach, but it left lots of other questions out.
Mm-hmm. Right. Okay.
It was a way of trying to talk about the questions without necessarily giving up, you know, saying yes, you need to have government spending. And it's meant to both stabilize the economy and also do other things.
Yeah, so John Maynard Keynes was a British economist. And because the governments have the power to print money, right? You know that governments have fiat power to just make money up. But if you just create money, you also create inflation and you actually devalue your own currency. But if there's not enough private investment, private means like corporations and small business owners, you know, people to invest in things, and the economy goes down and doesn't have the kind of growth, even negative growth, which is possible, then the government can stimulate the economy by pouring money into the economy, which isn't good in the short run. But if that gets the economy going and people start paying taxes, then the government can pay itself back and restore the deficit through increased tax revenue. So it's a form of structural economic manipulation, right? It's strategic manipulation of the economy because the government has the power to print money, to create money out of nothing. But if done strategically, then it could create stability in a nation's economy rather than relying completely on private market forces. So private means non-governmental. So public corporations in this kind of situation would be part of the private sector. Yes, Mark.
So I'm trying to understand that first graph from the first time, mm-hmm. when you're talking about the city-state and the neighborhood state. Are you saying that all these things are happening throughout all those stages, but they're just happening on a different scale now? Or is this like a new...
Well, technology has made us more interconnected across national boundaries.
Right.
Before, even though there was still trade, most of the economy was in a country. And so that gave the government the ability to manage its economy in a way that was more stable and better for most people.
You know, is that your question, Mark?
Well, I guess my question is, like, manipulating the economy or making money, those things have always been happening, mm-hmm. even in these other different city states.
Yes, that's true.
But now you're saying that it's just global.
Well, what Keynesianism does is make a kind of a doctrine or formula about that. Like it's not just willy-nilly, like whenever the king feels like it, but like when the economy dips to a certain percentage, then this would be a good time to stimulate the economy. So he kind of made it more scientific, more rational. So you're right that it's not like he invented government intervention in the economy. That's been happening, yes, since the rise of city-states. But it is a kind of a formula that worked relatively well right up until the 1970s, and we're going to get to that, I think, next week. Stagflation is a new word that was invented by economists in the 70s that was a combination of stagnation and inflation. And those two things are not supposed to go together under Keynesian economics. And because there was Watergate, which greatly damaged U.S. credibility, at the same time as Watergate, there was the OPEC oil crisis, which showed that the U.S. is not sovereign economically. And when, you know, people were in line for 4 hours to fill up their gas tank, it really showed that the oil cartels, the Arab nations in particular, but even Venezuela and Russia and other oil-producing nations had real power that we could not control. And so our political turmoil, our economic turmoil, all of that led to Carter's presidency, in which he could not get us out of that combination called stagflation. And that gives rise to Reagan and neoliberalism for real, right? But basically, Carter's presidency is one in which Keynesianism stopped working. And that paved the way for the neoliberals to say, okay, our turn. We'll take over from here, right? All right. So I'll just read this last part. Are we at E? Okay, and then we'll take a break. World War II, 1939-45, and corporate growth. The U.S. did not join the Allied powers to fight fascism any more than we entered the Civil War to fight slavery, though that's how it was sold to the American public. Japan, part of the Axis powers, meaning allied with Nazi Germany and fascist Italy, was threatening American economic interest in China. Japan had already by this time become a colonizer of China. U.S. trade embargo against Japan in summer of 1941 was designed to provoke war. Sure enough, on December 7th, 1941, what FDR called the Day of Infamy, Japan attacked Pearl Harbor, a naval base in Hawaii, finally drawing the U.S. into the war. But the thing is, we could say Japan drew U.S. into the war, but also the U.S. drew itself or provoked Japan so that it had a pretext for war. That's a more accurate way of, and yeah. Well, it says it right here. It was designed to provoke war. American diplomats and businessmen made sure that the U.S. would be the preeminent global economic power at war's end. The U.S. bumped aside a crumbling British Empire at this time for oil deals in the Middle East. So the U.S. became the primary partner of these oil-rich countries. The U.S. also led in framing a new post-war international economic order based on a partnership between government and big business. So these neoliberal institutions like International Monetary Fund and the World Bank emerge in this time, 1944. This all culminated in dropping atomic bombs on Hiroshima and Nagasaki in 1945 in Japan, finally using a weapon American leaders were anxious to try out and assuring that the U.S. would occupy post-war Japan and blocking Russia. This was a way of signaling to the world, we are the dominant imperial power. No one better even try to lift a finger against us, because look what we can do with just one bomb, right? This was just an announcement to the world. Yeah. All right. So U.S. joins war not to fight fascism, but to protect its economic interests in China from Japan. U.S. replaces Britain as global economic power, and wealth generated through war is concentrated into ever fewer corporate hands. The corporation, the American corporation, just balloons, you know, explodes in power, in scope, in reach, in wealth, through World War II.
Do you have any examples of some of those corporations?
General Electric, General Motors, General Mills.
Made a real killing by supporting the rise of Nazi Germany.
According to Warner Brothers cartoons, Acme. Acme becomes the biggest corporation ever.
Helping Germany come into, Nazi Germany recuperate the German economy made a lot of money for U.S. financiers.
Yeah.
Huge amount of money.
John?
Say more about how Japan was threatening American economic interests in China.
Yeah,
a really new point for me.
Oh yeah, Japan had first colonized Korea as its first foray into colonization, basically. Okay, let me spin us backwards to 1853, when the U.S. sent gunboats up Tokyo Bay with Commodore Perry to force Japan to sign an amity treaty, which meant that the U.S. can go in and economically colonize Japan, right? And that makes the Japanese government fall apart. So they decide to put their pieces together and start industrializing Western style. And Japan's goal is to get the U.S. off its back permanently. But the only way it can do that is to create a bigger and bigger sphere of defense in the Pacific from U.S. interest. But the U.S. is already an imperial power in the Pacific and has already shown its dominance over Japan in the 1850s. So Japan decides to, if you can't beat them, join them, and become a Western-style industrial power to eventually overthrow the U.S. But the U.S. easily forgets history. So as Japan industrializes, it becomes an easy foreign market for U.S. corporations. So the U.S. thinks that it is allies with Japan. See, this is a crazy thing. The U.S. actually thinks Japan is an ally this time. But the Japanese are playing the U.S. and they're like, we're not forgetting 1850s. You are, but we're not. So it buys and sells with the U.S. And then it even says, hey, we'd like to colonize Korea. And then all of that timber and fish and rice and all kinds of other goods can be, you know, part of the trade, and then you'll get richer, and we will too. And Teddy Roosevelt says, "Go for it." So Teddy Roosevelt gives Japan permission in 1908 to colonize Korea, which they do. 1910, and then the Philippines are involved somehow, and then Japan is emboldened by that. And in the 1930s, it colonizes Manchuria, a huge section of northeast China, and is basically using all of those raw materials, labor, basically almost slave labor, and resources to build up its economy, to build massive warships, bombs, missiles, guns, all that stuff. The U.S. thinks that Japan is becoming a major trading partner like Germany and England and other European powers. The U.S. is fine with that because it's making a lot of money off Japan. But Japan is building all this up in order to eventually wage war against the U.S. and have and basically control so much of the Pacific that the U.S. never becomes a threat to Japan again. In other words, the U.S. would never be able to come into Tokyo Bay, which is once the U.S. to have that ability again. That's what Pearl Harbor was about. So I don't know if I explained, if I answered your question. Kind of. The big picture. So this is one of the big surprises about Japan is that Japan was actually a frenemy, right? Before that term became popular.
Well, and I don't know if this is what John was talking about, but China had lost its imperial power. It waned after Indochina, Indo-Russia, Indo-Sino, the Sino-Russian. I mean, those are the wars that really, really kind of brought them down from its, I mean, for millennia. I mean, China has been the middle imperial Asian power, right? Every country knows that. We don't mess with China. But right around the late 1900s is when China really wanes because of its lack of naval ships, lack of westernization, because it's so central. And I think that's when Japanese ambition, as ambitious as it wasn't going to touch China.
Right? Yep.
And I think that's the kind of catalyst where I think U.S. understands China. You know, Japan starts to kind of show itself, but it's really China that's the other imperial power that's not spoken of.
That's good background. So China is carved up by European powers, and it's so weakened that Japan decides to exploit the chaos. So Japan wages war against China in 1895 and wins. So then it's able to not colonize a whole section yet, but begin the process. And then in 1905, Russia wages war against Japan, thinking it can increase its territory, but it loses. So Japan wins two major wars against massive neighbors, China and Russia, right? So Japan... And also, you know, it's not like Russia and China are necessarily friends of the U.S. So the U.S. doesn't care as long as the Japanese appetite, you know, also means increasing market and trading by the U.S. So this is where we are, where war and capitalism go hand in hand. And even like great economic catastrophes like the Great Depression are ultimately solved by war. And there was a depression in 1914 that's solved by World War I. The Great Depression that lasts, you know, over 10 years that's solved by World War II. Lori? Please.
Okay, so the reason in my mind, and tell me if I'm wrong, the U.S. really is the ultimate winner of World War II is other than Pearl Harbor, we weren't invaded. Like, our factories are still up and running. Our, you know, whereas, like, all of Europe was invaded by Germany, so all of their... Or, okay, but generally, so their factories are down. Their industrial is going... They have to repair.
Right. There are not that many fully industrialized nations around the world, right? Like, even today, think about this. How many countries make cars? Very few. Even in Europe... Only England, France, Sweden, Germany, Italy make cars. I mean, very few countries have the industrial capacity to make cars, even today. So at the end of World War II, that's a very important observation. All the industrial nations destroy each other. The U.S. is the only fully functioning industrial nation in the world. That means the U.S. basically has a monopoly on industry for 20-plus years. Now, Japan quickly industrializes through U.S. help again, and then the Marshall Plan is to get the European economy back on its feet again as a bulwark against Soviet Union on the one hand, and also as a convenient market for American goods on the other. But, you know, it takes decades to go from rubble to, you know, functioning factories that make competitive goods and services, right? So the U.S. basically has a monopoly on industry for decades. And that's where we see the post-war boom. I mean, imagine, you know, if you have hardly any competition around the world for everything that you manufacture. Toussaint?
So if I understand correctly, wars are so profitable because of weapon selling, the reconstruction aspect of it, because once everything is destroyed, I mean, people need to rebuild. And so because of the debt that it can generate.
Right.
Those are the reasons why it's so profitable, like wars are so...
Right. It creates endless demand. I mean, like, if your city is leveled and you got to rebuild an entire city, how much is that going to require? So the U.S. basically fills the industrial vacuum, but the U.S. also, through its corporations, starts to control supplier nations, raw material suppliers nations all over the world, in Africa, in Latin America. So how are you going to supply Europe and Japan and many other places with the stuff to rebuild, right? You need raw materials. You need iron. You need timber. You need oil. So if the U.S. can control African nations and Latin American nations, Asian nations, Pacific nations that have those resources, bring it to the U.S., refine it, manufacture stuff, and then ship it to Europe, you're getting it at cut-rate prices because they're basically like your colonies. You know, you control them, and then you're getting finished goods prices in Europe. So this colonial control of the world is incredibly lucrative for the U.S. The U.S. steps in to that vacuum of global colonization and steps into the vacuum of industrial output because the European countries destroyed each other and basically can't effectively run their old colonies anymore, right? So the independence movements all happen in the 50s and 60s, but while these African and other nations became independent of old colonial, European colonial powers, they became dependent on U.S. neoliberal economic control, right? So the U.S. just basically replaced old European powers, that's all. All right, let's take a break. Okay. Look at me. Look at me, pay attention to me, 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 me. I know. I wish I were named Mimi, but it's a female name, unfortunately. All right. So, let's start. Part 3, neoliberal stirrings. Just a little bit of a wiggle into neoliberalism. The first half of the 20th century, both at home and abroad, was an era of anti-colonial, anti-racist, and anti-capitalist struggle, right? Think about the beginnings of the civil rights movement here in the U.S., the anti-war movement, but also the labor movement, and then the anti-colonial movement all over the world. The triumph of capitalism was not a given, and the world wars gave the financial elite new tools to control labor. Meanwhile, economists worked behind the scenes creating the ideal capitalist world, aiming to remove all barriers to profit. So now, economists were the high priests of the multinational corporations. Got it? So, we're going to talk about war here. A, manufacturing consent through war. Clever use of the word manufacturing, John. Thank you. The U.S. emerged from World War II as the sole economic superpower, but not the sole military one. Militarily, we had a bilateral world, right? The U.S. versus the USSR. But economically, there was really no competition. The war economy finally brought the U.S. out of the Great Depression. War also unified the working class as patriots against an enemy abroad, making it much more difficult to mobilize anger against corporations and their exploitative practices. War had pacified the population to such a degree that, get this, General Electric's CEO suggested a continuing alliance between business and the military for a permanent war economy. We cannot make this stuff up, people. Okay? Now, look. Now, we don't hear much about GE because, I mean, we don't even hear that much about General Motors because we have Google and we have Apple and we have Samsung and we have, you know, and Netflix and Amazon. But goodness gracious, in those old days, General Electric would have been all of that combined. That's how big and powerful it was. So when the CEO of General Electric says we should be on a permanent war economy, you know something's going on. The Truman administration would oblige. Truman was FDR's last vice president, who, when he died, became president. And then, did he win a second term? Yes. And he stoked anti-communist fear, escalated the military budget, and demonized all anti-colonial, anti-racist, and anti-capitalist revolutionary movements, both at home and abroad. This is the... Pardon me? Oh, linking all that to communism. This is the origin of the military-industrial complex central to neoliberalism today. Remember that it was, amazingly, one of our wartime generals, Dwight D. Eisenhower, who in one of his last speeches before ending his second term as President of the United States, warned the nation of the rising power of the military-industrial complex. That alone, to me, makes him one of the great presidents of the United States.
Then he struck the congressional part.
Interesting. Yeah. That would have been even more accurate. Because they had already bought Congress. And that's what's great about capitalism, is you can buy politicians too, in addition to everything else. All right. So, let's talk about war a little bit right now, okay? So, war makes an enemy abroad, and that means that anything domestic is on the same side, right? Even if corporations were oppressing me and exploiting economically, at least we're all on the same side compared to the Soviet Union, right? Who has nuclear weapons that can annihilate me. So, it's the mortal threat that creates very strange bedfellows, allies among traditional enemies. And war was so successful at controlling a population that, you know, the GE guy says that. So why is war so profitable and even essential to a capitalist economy? Because it's the mother of all stimuluses, right? Because to stimulate the economy means a massive amount of spending, okay? Spending is how you kickstart the economy. You know, people are anxious, they're worried, they don't have good jobs, their income is not going up, and the economy starts slowing down. Then you go to war. All kinds of things are destroyed, things that took centuries to build sometimes. And then, like we were saying before the break, you have to spend lots of money to rebuild. And then you also have to spend a lot of money even to destroy, right? It takes a lot of money to build ships and airplanes and bombers and bullets. So you spend a lot of money to wage war, and then you have to spend a lot of money to repair the damage of war. And that creates so much spending that corporations are churning out products and services. And then that gives people jobs. And that gets people to spend even more money. And then the nation's tax revenue grows dramatically, right? So however much the nation spent in war, the nation hopes to recoup that and then some through the tax revenue generated from all of that economic activity. So war is the single greatest stimulus there is. Here's another stimulus. In 2008, Sundbeck and I got a check for $800 or $1,200 from the federal government. Remember that? The stimulus package. Was it $1,200 for a family? We just got a check for $1,200 from the U.S. government. No strings attached. And we just put it right in our savings account because we didn't need that money. That money was wasted on us. You know? Because already... Why am I shooting myself in the foot here? Already by 2008, we had a stable enough income not to need desperately that $1,200 from the federal government and spend it. But if whoever, whichever poor people in this country got that $1,200, that immediately went to groceries, paying the utility bills, fixing the car, getting that tire you desperately needed, you know? And so when poor or working class people get that kind of stimulus, they spend it, and then the company that you bought that product from can order more, and then they're spending, and their employees are getting a raise and all that. So the U.S. government tried to stimulate the economy and get us out of the Great Recession by just giving cash to everybody, but in such a dumb way, right? They should not have given any stimulus, any free money to people who made, say, over $50,000. And instead of giving $1,200 to everybody, they should have given $5,000 to the poorest people who would have spent all of that, you know, immediately. And that would have had an incredible a cascading and stimulative effect on the whole economy. You see what I'm saying? But you give $1,200 to millionaires, that's even us, we were able to put it into savings. You give it to millionaires, it's completely wasted, because when that money goes in the savings account, that means it is not stimulating anything except sitting in a bank, and the bank will use that for speculative purposes, which is not stimulative, right? It's actually a drain on the economy when you gamble with the money instead of investing it in the productive sector. Yes?
So if, okay, so war creates jobs, basically.
Oh, so let me just finish with my thought, thank you. Because you reminded me. Which is even just giving throwing $1,200 at people's faces is one form of stimulation, right? But stimulus. But war is a magnitude more effective stimulus than what the federal government did to help us out of the Great Recession. You see what I'm saying? Those are examples of government stimulus. And that's what Keynesianism is about. And we're still doing it in a way. But it's basically what capitalism, what this one form of capitalism is about. Laura.
So isn't that what FDR was trying to do through the New Deal?
Yes.
Was it just that it wasn't to scale like war was?
Mm-hmm.
And that maybe the population wouldn't go along with the New Deal to such a great extent, but it would go along with it mm-hmm. for war? Or why did war work, but the New Deal didn't? To really stimulate the economy.
Let's hear from Daryl.
The New Deal was starting to work, but war does one other thing we haven't mentioned yet, and that is tempers people's expectations so that they're more willing to either buy war bonds or pay extra taxes, mm-hmm. so that they're willing to give up more on an individual basis.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Typically, to get something passed, you have to have a certain group that gains a lot from something that are willing to push for it really hard. Oftentimes, when you do spending for lots of people, helping people with the poor, the gains are very dispersed. But with war, the gains are very concentrated. And so those people who are very much gaining the most, they're the ones that are pushing for it the hardest. And they're the more likely to be successful.
Mm-hmm. Yep. And I would add something else, too. You know, when we had the Great Recession and Obama tried to stimulate the economy he was advised to pour $3 trillion into the economy as a stimulus. But it got pared down to $800 billion by Congress, right? So in that situation, basically Obama, there were economists who believed that spending at almost wartime levels would really have gotten us out of it much more quickly and thoroughly. I think they were right. But instead, the Congress pared it down to kind of a paltry stimulus, so where we've been hobbling along, and then we've called it a jobless recovery, because it was not enough great enough stimulus. Remember that the Supreme Court shot down FDR's New Deal policies time and again until he threatened to pack the Supreme Court with 6 new justices. He cannot fire Supreme Court justices; they're appointed for life. But he could manipulate the Congress to add 6 more justices, in which case he would get the majority he needed. The Supreme Court justices were so spooked by that threat that they started to pass New Deal. They started not to oppose the New Deal legislation, right? But even then, the Congress still slowed New Deal policies a lot. And they kept chipping away at the kind of stimulus that FDR really wanted. So the scale was much smaller. It wasn't as much as FDR wanted. And also remember, the population are immigrants, farmers, poor people. And that generation at that time was wired to save and to be frugal. And so, unlike now, everybody in America now is wired not only to spend everything we have, but even to borrow, you know, what we don't have and spend. But that generation were really frugal saving type. So the people also weren't wired to spend the way that the U.S. government needed them to spend to really get us out of the Great Depression.
The question on that one, why would the Supreme Court or like the Congress like vote down that kind of stimulus? What is in their interest to scale it down?
The point is basically this free trade mythos. Often they weren't great legal or economic scholars. They were appointed because they were seen as people who protected major capitalist interests. And they knew that passing this stuff would mean higher taxes, which would mean wealth transfers from the rich to everyone else. So they were opposed to it ideologically, and also because they were chosen for ideological reasons.
The political class, which includes Supreme Court justices, are basically designed to protect the status quo. Those are the people that get elected. The stimulus helps the overall economy, but it also means lots of poor people and working class people also get a lot of wealth. It was basically wealth transfer from rich to the poor. And that's not in the interest of the establishment, which the Supreme Court at that time was a part of, even if it ultimately helps the country. And by the way, that hasn't been tested. Keynesianism wasn't tested until FDR in the United States. So it could have failed big time. Now, it happened to work, and the World War II turned out to be an incredible stimulus that people at that time couldn't have predicted. And that's why Keynesianism became the economic law of the land for decades after that, until, as we said, not the stagflation of the 1970s. But the Supreme Court justices wouldn't have even known that it would have worked anyway. All right. Should we move on? So, now this is about the idea undergirding economics, an idealized economic world. Adam Smith in 1776 and John Stuart Mill in 1840s taught that economics was a science rather than the art of household management, right? Oikonomia, managing one's household. That it was a science that described the laws of human nature. Humans were primarily in this framework, self-interested. Yeah, John Stuart Mill really pushed hard the notion that humans were primarily self-interested, with a deep dislike of work, a love of luxury and leisure, and a desire to possess wealth. Basically, John Stuart Mill believed that our true human nature was that we were selfish jerks. With this assumption, there was a guy named Jevons in the 1870s who sought to model a nation's economy by starting with the calculating man as the basic building block. That is to say, an individual who seeks to maximize pleasure with every decision. By the 1920s, a guy named Frank Knight out of the School of Chicago, Chicago School of Economics, gave this figure the godlike ability, this person, to use perfect knowledge and foresight to weigh every possible factor and make the most rational economic decision, right? To take the information of the markets and say, after all, this rational calculation, to say, this is the best cell phone for me and the best carrier and best plan. That every person with economic information, you will use their rational, self-interested, calculating mind to make the best rational decision. Since human beings are now predictable, meaning human beings can be counted on to act in their rational self-interest, economics can now be refounded as an objective science and not just the art of managing one's household, whether personally or for the whole nation. This is the same old Western story of abstract universal objectivity, quote unquote, and the white supremacist assumption that Europeans alone could master it, right? If there's such a thing as objective knowledge and objective truth, then of course Europeans have the corner on that. Everybody else are like primitive, emotional, female-like creatures, right? Only the white male is the supreme rational, godlike, objective being. Right?
So is marketing the epiphany, but that's not true?
What?
That people don't act in their rational best interest.
Right. I mean, you know what? If people actually acted in their rational best interest, I wouldn't have a job. That means, as a pastor, I'm endlessly preaching and teaching and counseling people to actually be rational and not, you know, be self-destructive, right? Okay, see, the stage is set. By the end of World War II in 1945, the U.S. successfully domesticated the labor movement, suppressed dissent, like war protesters, severely restricted non-white immigration, advanced assimilation into whiteness, and created the burgeoning white middle class of post-war America. We've talked about all these things. Now this is the conclusion. The U.S. could now unify the nation against a new enemy to replace Hitler, the Soviet Union, and imperial communism. Democracy and capitalism became a virtuous duo. Hello? Did you just see what happened? Because of the threat of a spreading communism, all of a sudden, democracy and capitalism become a duo, and virtuous at that. And free market capitalism is now seen as the good guy versus the bad guy of state-controlled communism. So in 1947, 2 years after the end of World War II, 3 years after the Bretton Woods Agreement that establishes neoliberal institutions like the World Bank and the IMF, a small group of laissez-faire economists, drawing, meaning very little, if any, government regulation of business, drawing from the otherworldly economic vision traced above, gathered at Mont Pelerin, Switzerland, to draft a new story that will give rise to the neoliberal world we live in today. It is a story that has become so pervasive that today we would just call it common sense. Of course, we give all of our money, as much as possible, to the capitalist class because they're the ones who build factories and give us jobs, right? Of course. Of course, corporations are the good guys and the Soviet Union is the bad guy. Of course. That kind of thing. And I would also point you to the 2 pages. It's pretty extensive, although we had to even cut things out of here, of the timeline that helps us to see the things that happen that lead to our neoliberal economic world. And it also gives definitions to some of the terms that we've used. All right. We have a little bit of time for discussion or questions. So basically, war is the primary tool to enrich corporations. And then corporations also encourage the U.S. government to wage war on a regular basis to further enrich and enhance its power. So it's a virtuous cycle.
I just have a quick comment. So imperialism was about Europeans fighting against each other, right?
Right.
So World War One was the same thing, like colonies fighting against. And World War Two was about Germany trying to colonize. So all those world wars were always about like Europe, like at war. And so to me, I just find it like funny that, I mean, it's called World War because there's that assumption that if it's true in Europe, it's true everywhere.
Yeah.
And also, it made me think about like the differentiation, like concepts of the inability to tolerate like difference. So let's say we talked about John Stuart Mill.
Mm-hmm.
He had that assumption about human beings. So basically, we all selfish. So if it's true for you, it's okay.
Exactly.
It's true for everybody else. So
right. One of the features of Western people is their tendency to universalize their particular experiences and call it humanity.
And John Stuart Mill worked for the British East India Company for 20-some years and was a strong, strong proponent of colonialism. He's a strong apologist. So, and then he puts a theory like that out mm-hmm. there that becomes, you know, very dominant economic mm-hmm. theory.
So the U.S. fought in two primary theaters, the Atlantic Theater, European Theater, and the Pacific Theater, right? We already talked about the primary issue in the Pacific is Japan basically trying to regain its sovereignty vis-a-vis the U.S., right? And then in the Atlantic, though, with Europe, when Germany lost World War I, the Treaty of Versailles basically said, you have to pay for everything that was destroyed, and you have to pay interest on that. So it basically became real money on fake money on top of real money, and Germany, their industrial capacity was destroyed after World War I. They had to rebuild that. But how are they going to pay all these reparations to France, England, and the victors of World War I? You know how they did it? They printed money. And they had so much inflation, like the money was so worthless, that there are pictures of people in a wheelbarrow full of cash that could not even buy a loaf of bread. Yeah, you can do something with a wheelbarrow. And so, like, the bread is real, but the money was fake. So basically, Germany, it's also a kind of a passive-aggressive move. It was like, oh, you want money? Here's you know, truckloads of money. You can have it. They're just printing it out of nothing. And the Weimar Republic basically collapsed because of the economic depression that was caused. And the no confidence in the German people's belief in their own country. So Hitler steps into the vacuum and says, not only are we going to not pay what the Versailles Treaty says, no, we're going to take over those people that won. And then we're going to own everything. You know, we're going to own France. We're going to own England. We're going to own all this stuff. And so instead of paying that way, they're going to pay us this way. So World War II is directly connected to World War I. And the U.S. really doesn't have a dog in that fight, in the Atlantic, really, except for its market and the threat to its economic interests if Hitler actually won.
At the end of World War II, the U.S. was in a position to conquer the entire world, and they didn't. That was the first time ever that happened. I mean, we did other bad things, but we didn't choose to militarily conquer the world like we could have, because the Soviet Union could not really compete with us militarily because they destroyed the power of their peasant class, because Stalin was afraid of...
Do you mean economically?
They couldn't compete with us economically,
yeah,
because Stalin had broken the back of their peasant class, their agricultural production, mm-hmm. by inducing a famine. And that made it so that their economy was very much crippled for most agricultural production. Mm-hmm. That then made it hard for them to develop economically and everything else besides military stuff.
All right.
The other primary reason we ended up in the European theater was Germany did make the mistake of disrupting our commercial supply lines.
Right.
Pretty regularly. And
yeah.
And the same thing in World War I, actually.
That's right.
They almost made that same mistake.
Yep. Yep.
That it was just sort of those, you know, one too many one too many pushes mm-hmm. on our economy.
Right. There are submarines called U-boats were sinking the supply ships where U.S. was making money hand over fist supplying European powers in World War I. So the U.S. got in that way. And then in World War II, Germany was sinking U.S. ships again, you know, so that the U.S. would stop supplying England and France and other allied powers with necessary material.
They also, I mean, they had ambitions on controlling the U.S.
Yeah.
at some point, or at least to some extent, much in the same way, though, as Japan wanted to end our mm-hmm. fleet. Germany wanted to prevent us from being a useful ally.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and
the enemies of Germany.
And it was said earlier that the U.S. did not become an outright imperial power after World War II when it could have. I totally agree with that. However, I think the U.S. gets too much credit for that. The U.S. became a subversive imperial power after World War II rather than an explicit imperial power like Great Britain. So it's really the cleverest empire the world has ever seen, because we basically control the economics and even the politics of much of the world without actually occupying, which is extraordinarily costly in personnel, in money, in goodwill, and in the way that a country can be unified, and in the brand. You know, America is not just a country, we're a brand. So to be able to economically and politically exploit the world without actually occupying is really clever. And that's basically what we've done. Yes, Ms. Kim.
So when you really look at the tribal and clan stage to where we are, especially Europeans colonizing, and then Japan copy that.
Mm-hmm, yes.
When you think about it, you know, of all this time, this where we are now, we not only destroy Earth, but also we destroy so many humans and so many sufferings, you know. So now I have a question to you, is this. Right now we have two crazy guys, in one end Kim Jong-un, and one end Donald Trump.
Yeah.
And then even though that I, you know, at my age, you know, over 70, I'm a very conservative person in Korean politics.
Mm.
But however, I feel that it's a guy, maybe it's a little God's work there. We got the right president in South Korea, maybe to prevent.
Uh-huh.
Now, you know, there's a lot of this, you know, like threat of World War III.
Right.
I just hope that that, including maybe Trump's impeachment, I don't know, but that really to steer to other direction, to not to ignite the war, the horrible war, where I am, where our mother left.
Mm-hmm.
And then lastly, with my family history there, my father, my rotten father, he was the first group of Samsung manager. I mean, you know, he went to Gyeongsang University, and my mother was a school teacher elite, but he chose communism because he was against USA policy back there.
Right.
Just destroyed all our family. So it's just a lot of pains.
Yeah.
It's just horrible when you think about how Japan kills so many. I mean, just killing, war, and colonizing. It's just really distorting, and then destroying our Earth.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Thank you for sharing that. Lori, and then Myung-chan.
So is there some kind of, I mean, so for every single war listed, the textbooks and what we tell our children, there was like a good, like we went into that war, to, you know, to save the Jews from the Holocaust. Or, you know, we tell our children that we justify it through like something horrible that the enemy was doing, whether we won or lost.
Right.
So is there like some level of shame in this economic system in which we lie? Like even, I was just telling Stephen, like Helen Keller was actually huge in the socialist movement.
Mm.
We have letters back and forth from all those other leaders that were in prison. She was never in prison, but she explicitly said before she died that she did not want to be known for overcoming her disability. She wanted to be known for being a leader in the socialist movement. And not only did she just not told about, but she was told about in this like really demeaning way for what she actually did.
Yeah.
So we even took these people and turned them and changed. I mean, it was so intentional, like, every children's nonfiction and every school has something about Helen Keller, but never about her, what her life was about. And that's just one simple example.
Yeah.
So is it a level of shame? Like, what's the benefit to lying to the next generation? And the reason that we even have to have this, because we didn't learn all this stuff. Like, what's the advantage to keeping the general populace out of the know that it's actually corporations and economics that control everything?
I mean, one lesson for me as I've looked at this history again is that the early 1900s in the U.S., there was a lot of political activity on the part of people everywhere. I mean, like, sit-ins, strikes, getting involved in political movements, socialism was a serious political force in the 1910s. And then they created the Espionage Act and all this to, you know, to say you can't speak against the war, but they used it to get rid of all the socialist leaders in prison.
The Red Scare.
Yeah, and then the 1920s, of course, media and all that, and they figured out ways to change the narrative. And then the 1930s, after, in the Great Depression, you have all these movements again, and you have huge unrest amongst the population. There is huge divides between the working class and the elite capitalist class, huge. And so World War II then, this construction of consent, an enemy, Hitler, and then realizing how much you can unify people around patriotism, how powerful that is, and then you create just enough security through the construction of the white middle class after the war, and people are pacified. So like I think about today, and what is a typical white middle class American? Totally apolitical, not that aware of history, mainly focused on consumption and security. All of this was something that it took two huge world wars to create that kind of a person.
Mm-hmm.
And the whole push for Americanization. This was intentional for a number of decades to create the typical white middle class American who is just going to be pacified and not involved and not care. And
domesticated.
Domesticated. Once you have that person in place, then a neoliberal economy works. Because they're alienated, disconnected, they just want to consume, whatever, and then you can get away with anything. And these corporations do get away with anything now. So
basically, we have neoliberal feeding tubes in our nostrils.
Yeah.
And we're just immobilized in bed, and we actually think we're moving around and have autonomy and doing what we want, but we're basically completely controlled by the neoliberal economic corporate arrangement. So why are we not told? Guess who owns Hollywood? Guess who owns the music industry? Guess who owns the textbook companies, the publishers? Guess who owns even our intellectual think tanks? Do you know corporations fund the Cato Institute, the Brookings Institute, the Heritage Foundation? Our most prominent intellectual centers are actually funded by corporations. We don't even have an independent intellectual class in this country.
Since the 80s, funding for research and universities has been declining, and it's harder and harder to get time to research to try and do it in academia, unless you're serving a corporate interest.
We really don't have an intelligentsia in this country like many other countries have, because we have been basically manipulated into bare survival, like just barely making it each and every day, paying our bills, and then indebting us so much that even when we have decent incomes, we're constantly paying into our debt, or getting us hooked on consumption of some kind, endlessly replacing our flat screen TVs and our cell phones and our cars, and just like, I mean, it's crazy what we spend our time and energy doing. I mean, it's just another drug. So if someone is hooked on cocaine or alcohol, we look down on them, but we're basically hooked on consumer electronics and entertainment and all other kinds of nonsense. It's the same way of just keeping us not waking up to what's going on and resisting and agitating for a better way to live, a better quality of life, better health for ourselves, a better way to raise our children and have a constructive marriage. You know, like think about the stress on marriage. I mean, our all Americans, you know, jerks that we basically either have divorce or bad marriages. I mean, like, that can't be. But we have a society where it's almost impossible to have a happy marriage because of the stress required to just live day to day. You know, why is parenting so poor in America? Are we just inherently inferior as Americans? Are we like the lousiest parents from birth in America? But we really are lousy parents. But I would say it's just the kind of lifestyle we have, where we hardly can spend quality time with our children or have a community to raise our children together because we're in a neoliberal system, means that we're going to be jerks to our children and they're going to resent us for the rest of their lives, right? That's reality. And those of us who want to rise up and have a better quality of life, I don't care about communism, socialism, capitalism, I don't care about any isms. Just having space for a good marriage, good children, good community, good church, good food, good health, just that, just basic stuff. We have a system that makes it virtually impossible to live like that. That's wrong. That's evil. And we need to wake up and stay woke so that we can create a different alternative. But if we actually start making real progress, you know we're going to get some serious opposition. So we're going to have to burn these tapes. Yeah, burn those digital tapes. Oh, I'm sorry, Myeongchan.
Post them on Facebook.
I guess today's lesson, the key point is to see the bare face of the America, and it's within the 1 day. Maybe most of the time we purify the American images, but underlying there is also a big issue. But if some aspect that any time of time, if you put this microscope, any time of period, any country, any time, they may have always their underlying period.
It's true.
Hard to find. I mean, just as free as other countries have seen. Some other, nowadays, more sophisticated countries show up because you don't have to using the power or colonize other country to exploit their resource. They're using the just company, globalization company, and that is the trend of the, because we have much more tool to travel and we can influence other countries, other countries in the compared to ancient way. So that is the overall trend. So it's my question was, what can we do?
Yeah.
I mean, what some part of the question or answer?
So well, I appreciate that, and I think that that's worth emphasizing that we're not naive that like the United States is an evil country and other countries are better. Not at all. I mean, there's a tremendous amount of evil going on in other countries and throughout history. Why are we making why are we making American the underlying script explicit? Because no country lies as well as this country does. That's the difference. It's not like Nazi Germany is more virtuous than we are. Of course not. But they also are very good at propaganda, right? And that is just something that Americans are so good at. It's also called marketing, right? So you want to use a classic word, be propaganda. You want to use a modern word, it's called marketing. But we market the heck out of American history. We don't tell the truth. We use euphemisms. So I'm not saying that America is a worse country than any other country. I'm just saying we have to understand reality, right? We're not trying to America bash here. We're trying to be America true. That's all. But it almost sounds like I'm bashing. I know, I even to myself, I know I can sound like that. Because the lies are so thick here. To just uncover the layers of lies to get to what actually happened in this country and how actually things work sounds like bashing because our rhetoric is so outrageously pie-in-the-sky pro-American, you know? Laura.
I was going to say, like, you also reap what we sow, though, and the kind of environment that you're in also shapes what you become. So, yes, everyone is greedy to some extent and has all kinds of different things, but the kind of system that you're in also perpetuates one thing or another. It perpetuates generosity and uplifts generosity, or it doesn't. I think, John, you were telling me about a study they did on economics students, a survey they did on students in college. I don't know how they conducted the survey, but...
Well, they tested students on generosity as they were coming in, all the different majors, and then as they were going out, and economics majors were consistently... would change the most as far as becoming selfish by the time they graduated.
Hmm.
But it's because they were being fed over and over that the human nature is self-interest and all of that.
So that's what builds wealth.
It creates the kind of
creates wealth.
It creates the kind of reality that it's talking about.
So I think that does make Americans a bit unique.
In the U.S. in the early 20th century, unions had to adapt to become more capitalist-like. And when they got power during the New Deal period, they were very self-interested. By contrast, in Europe, they were very relatively selfless, promoted a lot of other good causes, and as a result, had much wider power base. And unlike in the U.S., the union's back was broken in 1982, and that's caused part of the decline in the U.S., the way union power has been declining since the early 80s. Mm-hmm. And that was only possible because they were relatively narrow in their economic interests.
Yeah. I'll let Babatope have the last word.
Already. I just want to thank you. I mean, thank you guys for this wonderful thing. I mean, this is so beautiful. I mean, whenever I kind of look at myself, so this just gives me a picture of, well, wow, this is just beautiful, this is good. So thank you guys. I know it's a lot has gone into behind the scenes and for you guys to be able to. So thank you so much for this wonderful gathering and to be able to get us educated and about the society that we live in. And I totally agree with you having to do with the United States of America. I think, you know, we like to reap, to kind of reap the benefits of the rhetoric that we did. We're wonderful, we are here. So but when you see someone that are really conscious and really know what they're doing and being able to bring it back, that it kind of appears like, well, you are bashing the United States of America. Because for me personally, if I had not been to the United States, based on what I've heard, what I've seen, there are a lot of things that are happening here right now that when I call people, I tell people back home, they say, you are lying. No, that's not happening.
That's right.
So if I had not been here myself, there's some certain things that I probably would have been told that I would deny it's never going to happen in the United States. And I think one of the wonderful things about Trump's presidency.
Did you say a wonderful thing about Trump's presidency?
Yeah. And I think it destroyed the notion of any exceptionality. You know what I mean? I mean, what he's doing right now, I mean, African, if you're an African, Eastern African, we used to this. I mean, we know what he's doing. I mean, what he's doing right now is not new. But other presidents have done it before, but they have done it in a very panache way, in a way that is sophisticated.
Yes, right.
You know, but he's just doing it as a dictator. This is how to function.
Raw.
I'm going to come in your house and do it. What are you
going
to do? That kind of a thing. Now you can fire FBI. Barack Obama would have done the same thing, but in a way that it sort of speaks to your sensibility.
Right.
I think I understand it. I think it makes sense for this guy to be fired. Not just fire someone and just say, okay, I'm firing you because of the way you treated Hillary Clinton.
Right.
that's not, you know, so I really appreciate what we're doing, and I really, really want to. But one thing that really bothers me, and I don't know how we got here, as a people, how we got here, is the level of ignorance in this country. I've never seen any ignorance. I mean, you can be in the remotest part of Africa and be well informed about the affairs of the world and people living in the United States. So I don't know where that ignorance came from. I mean, just the ignorance. In Africa, people knew what's going on, but it's just that they are helpless. I mean, just because of the economics. So they know what's going on, that way you don't mean well for us, but we are helpless anyway. So whatever you do.
Right.
And especially if someone like myself, when I try to have conversation with Americans, I mean, you don't get two reactions. You go back to your country. Mm-hmm. Or you don't know what you're talking about. I mean, you're an immigrant.
Where does that come? Well, I would conjecture our nation's origin in religious utopianism, coupled with the myth of American exceptionalism, the manifest destiny, that we were warring Europeans, but now we're supreme white people in America. All of that mythology leads white Americans to have this permanent fetish for innocence. So they don't really want to know, because I call it a fetish for innocence. It's rampant, it's pervasive, and I would say it's almost without exception. I hardly know a white person that doesn't have this driving need to be personally innocent. And it's a very strange thing, because that's not my culture. I mean, we're a collective people, and we collectively sin, and we collectively do well, but white people are individualistic, and then they have to be pure in God's sight, so they have to be personally innocent. And the only way, in the midst of an incredibly oppressive society, with our foundation of land theft, genocide, and slavery, is basically to not know. So ignorance becomes the primary tool to maintain innocence. And because it is so insisted upon, despite all evidence to the contrary, it can be nothing more than a fetish, right? And so how to cure white people of the fetish for innocence is truly a monumental challenge. And we're actually trying to do that at Church Foundations, right? Cure our people of that fetish. But that fetish, by the way, destroys marriage. Because, you know, married couples that I've noticed can't confess and repent because they need to insist that they had good motives, right? However much I've hurt you, I meant well. That's the primary thing that white people are obsessed with, that they have good intentions. This is just crazy, you know, why that would be so important. But through our background, that's the kind of people we have. And it leads people not to be honest and real and get to the bottom of things. So we're constantly covering over real problems and covering it over with ideology and propaganda and marketing on top of marketing, right? So we just can't seem to really solve our problems because the average American isn't interested in solving the problem. They're interested in their personal innocence project. Mic drop. All right. Somebody close us in prayer. Doggone it.
Right now.
Thank you.
Yep. Okay. Heavenly Father, we just bless you for this wonderful opportunity. We just thank you for gathering us in a place such as this. We thank you for the ministry of this church. We thank you for the people that you have brought to this church. And we just thank you for the timing of this church. We give you all the glory.
Amen.
We thank you, Lord, for this ministry, because this is a wonderful ministry that we should, all that we have been taught, that we can carry these into our different spheres of life and be able to affect people's lives positively and be able to preach the gospel in our own capacity. And the essence of this is not for us just to know what we have learned today, but to be able to use that in our dealings with other people. And we just ask that the pastors of this church, they have done their part to have told us, to have preached consistently, to keep us in the right in the way of the Lord, to expose the truth to us. And we just pray that as we have received this truth, that we will be empowered to go in the water and actually walk in the
yes, Lord.
And reflect this truth as well. We might not be able to save the world, but those that you would direct our paths, that our lives would reflect God and Christ to them. We give you all the glory, and as we go home, we ask that your presence would go with us.
Amen.
In Jesus' name.
Amen. Thank you all for a wonderful evening.